Join Sam and Will as they bring the Bible's stories to life through historical evidence and try not to feel out of place in a car garage, all while bringing you Under the Hood.
Welcome to Under the Hood. I'm your host, Will. I'm here with Sam. Sam, what are we talking about today?
Today, we're going to be talking about one of the stories that people think is the craziest in Scripture. It's where God actually comes to Abraham, the father of the faith, and he's going to instruct Abraham to take his son, who had been the son of promise, and to sacrifice him as a burnt offering on a mountain. And when you read that, it is really jarring.
Yeah, it's hard to look past that God would come to a father, especially this father that's been waiting. We'll get into the story, but waiting for this child for decades. And he says, oh, no, just go sacrifice him.
Yeah, and so everything we know about God being this benevolent, kind, sacrificial, merciful, forgiving God, when you hear him say to a person that he has pursued and called and loved so much to be like, okay, now I want you to go and I want you to kill the kid that I promised you 25 years ago, or actually more than that by the time you get to this point. It's shocking. It doesn't make sense to us. And everything in us wants to say, no, God, you can't do that. You can't ask that. And the critics of Christianity look at this and say, what kind of God would do that? He must be, you know, as some atheists have called him, a malevolent bully or a child abuser. Like, that's the reputation that they want to throw on God. But as we'll see in the story as we go through it today, it's actually really beautiful, and it's calling humanity away from that.
Yeah, and this is one of those stories that we should have that kind of, even as Christians, this jarring reaction, be like, okay, why God? And that's the purpose of this show in many ways, is saying, okay, there is a why, now let us unpack it a little bit.
That's exactly right. Like, we hear that with our modern ears and we say it's aberrant because it is. Like, child sacrifice is absolutely appalling. But if you study history, you can go to every continent on the planet where human beings live, and you will find cultures that engaged in child sacrifice where it was seen as an honorable thing. And in fact, that remained reality for much of the world until Christianity spread and began being exported all over the world to these cultures.
Okay, that's quite the claim. So where can we start with all that?
Well, let's go, like, if you were to say, okay, in the ancient world before Christianity spread, they spread in the middle of the Roman Empire, right? Like, mm-hmm. The Roman Empire had the influence of the Greeks. Some of the greatest philosophers come out of there. And yet when you look at the tables of the Roman law, for instance, just listen to this. This is in the legal code. They say a notably deformed child shall be killed immediately.
Wow.
In other words, if you have a child that is not up to standards with what a Roman citizen should be, you kill it. You go back to Sparta, and what would they do with deformed kids?
Just leave them out.
They would leave them out. They would throw them off of cliffs. There was the famous practice that's known as exposure, where it's like, I don't want this kid. So you just lay the child out for beast or the sun to bake, and they would die by the elements. And this is in Rome. Like, Rome is supposed to be this great high place in life. Here's the Celtic culture of the first century, right? So, okay, let's go up into Europe to where the Celtics were. Listen to this. They describe building what's called the Wicker Man. And they would build this huge wooden structure. And then they would take human beings and children and animals, and they would all load them in this wooden structure to be one great big offering to the gods. And they would light this thing on fire. And the historian Strabo points this out. Here's another one, Plutarch. This one's really disturbing. So we go down to Africa, the northern coast, first century in the Roman Empire. And listen to what he says when he goes there, because he's totally caught off guard, not with the fact that children are dying, that's happening in the Roman world,
yeah,
but how they're doing it. Listen to this. He says, with full knowledge and understanding, they themselves offered up their own children, and those who had no children would buy little ones from poor people, and this is disturbing, and would cut their throats as if there were so many lambs or young birds. And meanwhile, the mother stood by without tear or moan, but should she utter a single moan, or let fall a single tear, she had to forfeit her money, and her child was sacrificed nonetheless.
Wow.
And so that's Plutarch writing about the ancient city of Carthage. Well, what happens after the first century? You have Jesus who comes into the world, who teaches this ethic of life. He takes the principles and the ethic of God and the resurrection and the ascension, and the gospel begins to go all over the world. And in the second century, you get a guy named Tertullian, who lives in that very same city of Carthage. And he's writing to the Romans. And listen to what he says. He's like, okay, you make fun of the Carthaginians for our practices, but let me tell you what you're doing, Rome. He says, you expose them to the cold and hunger and to wild beasts, or else you get rid of them by the slower death of drowning, which was a popular one where they would kill their kids by throwing them in water. You must not overlook the fact that it is your own dear children whose life you quenched. And the early church, with the ethic that comes out of the Bible, began warring against this idea of child sacrifice, and it was outlawed in 374. One of the earliest writings of Christianity is called the Didache, and that was the teachings of the 12 apostles condensed into a teaching booklet. And listen to what they say. There are two ways, one of life and one of death, but a great difference between the two ways. You shall not, this is in one of the chapters, you shall not murder a child by abortion or give that which is, or kill that which is begotten. And so this ethic began to spread. And when Christianity went throughout the Roman world, guess what stopped?
This.
Child sacrifice. And so you could move that to other places. When the explorers came to Central America, guess what the Aztecs were doing in large numbers? When they would not have a rain season, they would begin slaughtering children until it began to rain. We found mass graves. The New York Times not long ago reported that in Peru, they find evidence of the Incas. They did the same thing where they would kill massive numbers of children in an effort to pray. Here's one of the ones that's more disturbing that comes up even close to modernity. In the 1800s, you had a missionary whose name was William Carey. He's very famous. He was a missionary that went to India. And when he got there, he wrote back home about practices that he found the Indians doing. And they were shocking. One of them was called sati, where when the man died, the widow, like, what value is her life without a husband? And so they would put his body on a funeral pyre and burn his remains. And she, while she's still living, would be thrown on top of it to burn along with him.
Wow.
And there was another practice where it was written about where to show devotion to the gods, when you had multiple children, you would take one of your future children and you would sacrifice the child by throwing the child into the Ganges River. And so William Carey, when Britain colonizes India, he writes, he says, I've presented three petitions, representations to government for the purpose of having the burning of women and other modes of murder abolished. In the case of infanticide and involuntary drowning in the river, laws were made to prevent these, which have been successful. And so you have that in India up until the 1800s where this was going on. You still have it today in Uganda, where they're struggling to eradicate child sacrifice, where they would kill children and bury body parts on the person's property so that it would bring them good fortune in their minds. And so when you get to the days of Abraham, which is where we are today, full circle, come back to that, the land where Abraham is living, the land of Canaan and the Canaanites who inhabited it, were well known for slaughtering children and burning them in the fires of worship to false gods.
Okay, so this makes a lot more sense. So we come to the story of Abraham, that it wasn't crazy in his mind that a God would come to him and say, hey, child sacrifice is okay, and I want you to participate in it for my worship.
That's right. I mean, you go to some of the oldest books that are found in the Old Testament, and they talk about the inhabitants of this land doing exactly that. So, for example, in Psalm 106, listen to what it says. They sacrificed their sons and their daughters to the demons, meaning these false gods. They poured out innocent blood and the blood of their sons and daughters, whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan, and the land was polluted with their blood. And a couple of the famous gods of the ancient cultures were Shamash was one, Moloch was another one. And what they would do, they believed they would have these gods in like a bronze statue, and they would light a fire underneath the gods so that, you know, as bronze heats up, what's it do? It glows. It looks like he's coming to life. And they would have an arms outstretched, and people would come, and the priest would take their child, put him in the arms, and because the metal was heated up and melting, it would look like the god was accepting the sacrifice because the weight of the child would drop the arms and the child would fall into the fires. And so in the Old Testament, you find the writings of Moses where he's giving the law to Israel. Listen to what he says, because God clearly is not a fan of this. He says, you shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. For every abominable thing that the Lord hates, they have done for their gods, for they even burn their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. That's Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy 18, one more. There shall not be found among you anyone who burns his son or daughter as an offering. For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord. And because of these abominations, hear that, the Lord your God is driving them out before you. So he gives this to Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 18, right before Joshua is going to go in and take the promised land. And God gives a purpose statement for why he's driving those Canaanites out. And what is it? They're killing their kids.
Wow.
And because of that, for that reason, I am driving them out. And so does God like child sacrifice? Like up front, let's just be very plain. Like the word of God is very clearly saying, do not do that. That's reprehensible. It's an abomination, which then begs the question, why in the world does he come to Abraham and say, hey, I've got an idea. I want you to take your son and go offer him up as a burnt offering on a mountain I'm going to show you. Like, why would that happen?
Yeah, it does seem odd that we go to Deuteronomy, which is after the story of Abraham, and God's all of a sudden like, no, 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 this is bad, this is awful. But then we rewind back to Genesis 22, where Abraham's going to have all this happen. It's like, okay, did God change, or is the same God that met Abraham the same God who gave us the law?
To answer that question, we first have to enter into the story of Abraham and Sarah. So when we first meet Abraham, he's been living in the city of Ur. We've uncovered the ruins of ancient Ur. We know what it was like. It was this massive metropolitan city of the ancient world, very, very wealthy. They had their ziggurat, the staged pyramid in the middle of the city. It was one of the more influential cities that had one of the oldest legal codes in the ancient world called the Ur-Nammu Law Code. But one of the things that we know about the city of Ur that's really, really relevant for this story is that they had a patron god called Nana. And Nana was a god of fertility. We've uncovered lots of artwork involving Nana, and he's always pictured with a crescent moon, which was a symbol of fertility in the ancient world. So Abraham is growing up, spends the first several decades of his life in a city where what is the chief value? If your chief god is a god of fertility, what's the chief value?
Kids.
Kids, have kids, have lots of kids. That shows that heaven favors you, right? What's Abraham's problem?
No kids.
No kids. Like right at the beginning, when we're introduced to Abraham, we're told that his wife Sarah had no kids and she was barren. Mm. So for all these years, Abram, which is his original name, before God changes his name to Abraham, his name is Abram in the Hebrew. And what that means is exalted father. So now add that pressure to it.
Wow.
Terah, his dad, looks at him when he's a little boy and is like, my greatest hope for you, in fact, I'm going to give you this name, is exalted father, because I can't wait for you to what?
Have
lots of kids in a city where the highest virtue is having lots of kids, right? And so the city of Ur, we know, gets conquered by the Elamites in the ancient world. And so Terah, at that point, presumably, picks up his family, and they leave Ur. They go to another city, which a lot of people think that Terah founds. It's called Haran. And guess what? There's only one other ancient city in the entire world that worshipped this god as the patron god, Nana, the god of fertility. Guess where it is? Haran. And so he moves from Ur, founds another city, and makes Nana, the fertility god, again, the ultimate god. And so now Abraham is living in another place where he's reminded all the time. Every time he hears his name, he's reminded of the failure. Every time he goes to worship, he's reminded of the failure. His entire city looks at him and says, you're not contributing the next generation. Abraham would have felt this as a crushing weight, and as would Sarah have felt this as a crushing weight. And when God first comes to Abraham and Sarah, he's 75 years old.
Mm.
Kids are in the rearview mirror by that age, right?
Yeah.
Sarah's 65, which means she's almost certainly, unless there's some crazy miracle going on, she's postmenopausal. Childbearing years are done, right? And what does God say? Everything that you've put your whole hope in, when he introduces him in Genesis chapter 12, everything that you've put all your hope and faith and value in, leave it.
Mm.
You come follow me. I'll make your name great. You're ridiculed here. You follow me, I'll make your name great. You have no children, I'll make you a great nation. You're ridiculed here, I'll bless your friends, I'll curse your enemies. And through you, this is the big promise. This is where salvation comes into the story. Through your descendant, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Now, what does that mean? That means what that's pointing to is Abraham is going to have a child who's going to have a child who's going to have a child. You go through the line, Isaac to Jacob to Judah, and on down the line, 2,000 years later, that line is going to produce a son that will save all of humanity and bless all the nations, whose name is?
Jesus Christ.
Jesus. And so here you have God coming to Abraham for the first time in all the Bible. At the beginning of this whole story, in Genesis 3, God says, hey, I'm going to crush the head of the snake, and the seed of the woman is going to accomplish that, right? So from the get-go, it's like, who could that be? Anybody born of a woman, free game, they might be the savior. But all of a sudden, God comes to one particular person and says, Abraham, it's through your family. It's through your seed that I'm going to do this. And all of a sudden, the scope of who the Redeemer might be goes, and it narrows to Abraham's family. And so now the hope of the world, the salvation of the world, hinges upon this son of Abraham and Sarah. And so that makes this story even wilder, because God's saying the hope of salvation for all the world and everyone who has ever born and everyone who ever will be born lies on this son coming to fruition. Kill him and wipe out that line. Say what? Like, it's jarring. And yet God is trying to show Abraham, as we'll see, something really spectacular and beautiful.
And it makes a lot of sense now that you give all that background, that, you know, his name means exalted father. He was anything but an exalted father. His wife was barren for decades. And it just seemed like the shame would have overran him. The fact that God would come to him and all of a sudden he would be like, okay, I'll follow this God. I don't know this God. I don't know where he's taking me. I don't know anything. But anything is better than what I have here.
Yeah, I mean, that's the salvation story of so many of us. It's like you devote your life to finding your identity, your purpose, your value, and all these lesser things that leave you empty and never, ever reward you, right? And eventually God comes along and says, hey, you want to try this? You know, try me. And usually with humanity, it's like God's the last option.
Yeah.
And then you find, oh my goodness, this is totally satisfying. But in all the pressures, even in the second place where Abraham is called, he's called from a place called Haran. And one of the reasons why we think that his father founded that city and it's called Haran is Abraham has a brother who's named Haran. And that town is called Nahor, which is Abraham's other brother. So both of his brothers who have kids, they get places named after them. What do you not find a place named?
Abraham.
Even though he's the firstborn son. So it's very clear that Terah was playing favorites and Abraham felt like a disappointment. And so, like you said, when God comes to him and says, hey, why don't you try me? You've been trying this for 75 years. It has left you empty. Why don't you try me and see if I'm a God who can bring life to your story? And Abraham, I mean, this wasn't working for him.
Yeah.
And so he shows incredible faith, picks up, leaves his father's household, and all their gods, and follows after Yahweh.
And like we've talked about, Abraham goes out in amazing faith, but that's not the full picture of Abraham's story. He's not always the guy who gets it right.
No, it's like you read the story of Abraham as like the father of our faith, the hero of our faith, and you get whiplash reading his story because at one moment he's doing this heroic thing that's filled with faith, righteous as can be, and the next moment over here he's doing something that's utterly despicable that we look at him and we're like, I'm not sure I can like you. And what's fascinating is every time Abraham makes a really bad decision, the thing that's pressuring him to make that bad decision is death, the fear of death. So in Genesis 12, the very chapter where he's called, God says, hey, come to my land. I'm going to show you a land. He takes him to the promised land. And when he gets there, the land's in famine. And so now Abraham's looking around. He's like, okay, you gave me a couple of promises. One, I'm going to have a whole bunch of descendants. Sarah's still barren. And you promised me a land where I'm going to have this great nation. You brought me to this land and it's in famine. It is barren. What are you doing, God? Like, can you relate to that? Like, God doesn't always answer us, like, immediately and give us the promised land right away. And so Abraham's struggling with faith, and he's like, if I stay here in this land of famine where God has called me, I'm going to die. So he picks up and leaves there, and he shows a lack of faith, which is totally understandable. He goes down to Egypt, and Pharaoh's there. He's got a beautiful wife, and so what does he say to his wife? Pretend to be my sister, because the Pharaoh and these Egyptians are going to want to take you as their wife, so pretend to be my sister. Why? Otherwise, they might do what? They might kill me. You fast forward to future things, and it's like, well, my lifetime's running out, and Sarah's like, well, why don't you sleep with my maidservant? And Abraham's like, okay, because the clock's ticking. We only have so much time. And he does not, in those moments, those lapses of faith, he's like, I don't think God is going to provide life. So he does the same thing with Abimelech, where he says in chapter 20, you know, Sarah, pretend to be my sister, because if you're my wife, they might kill me to gain you. And it's like he's afraid of death at every turn, and you have this God who is promising, like, I want you to believe that I'm a God with a resurrection power. I can bring life to barren wombs. I can protect you. I can secure your life. Trust in me that I'm going to be a God who brings life out of death. And up until that point, Abraham goes from, yes, I believe, maybe not. Yes, I believe, maybe not. And in today's story, where God is saying, I want you to take the son of promise and I want you to sacrifice him, is the ultimate challenge, because this isn't Abraham. Abraham knows what's going on here. It's, do you trust me that I can take a son who has been sacrificed, and me being the God of life, the God of resurrection, the God that brings life from death, that I can raise him? And Abraham knows that that's what's going on here. And in Hebrews 11, if you read that, it says the whole reason why Abraham is willing to do this is he knew that God was a God of resurrection, and he believed that God would raise his son from the dead. Well, how did he reach that faith? Because through all of the chapters, 12, 13, 14, all the way up to chapter 22, what has he been learning? My goodness, this God can bring life out of the most hopeless circumstances. He can bring life to my marriage. He can bring life out of all these abysmal circumstances. And I'm learning slowly that he'd never make sense to me. Like, I don't understand why he made me wait 25 years for this promise to come true. I don't know why he brought famine to the land. I don't know the answers to all these questions. But what I do know is I've seen his character. I know he's a God of life. I don't understand why he's asking me to do this with Isaac. But I'm going to lean in, and I'm going to trust that this God will bring life from death. And he shows the most remarkable demonstration of his faith in this chapter at this request.
And as we enter into Genesis 22, we see that Abraham does have faith, and he's made mistakes, but he does see this God as a true God of resurrection life. But this would still be so difficult.
Yeah.
Because now this child that you've waited 25 years of just the promise, but 100 years of your life, and now you have a son who's a teenager who you've bonded with, whom you love, the one son you have, and God still calls you to sacrifice him.
And that's the tension, right? Like, you have a son that you love, that you've waited for, that, like, is the apple of your eye. It's the hope of humanity. And God comes and says, I want you to slay him. And this has been Abraham's position for his whole life, is looking at a circumstance that looks utterly impossible, right? There's famine in the land. I have to do something. I can't trust God because my circumstance outweighs the promise. And it's like, I'm going to look at the circumstance. Or can I trust God to keep me alive in Egypt? Can I trust God with all these different things? Because the reality is the circumstances of God's promise. She's 65 years old when this promise is made. Like, if you come and tell me my 65-year-old wife is going to be pregnant, I'm going to tell you that's not possible. Like, you don't understand. The circumstances won't allow it. And what it calls on Abraham to do is to say, which do you put more weight in? And this is where faith becomes real. Do you look at the circumstance that's utterly impossible, like a man rising from the dead after 3 days, right? Resurrection. Do you look at the circumstance and say, that's impossible? Or do you look at the promise and say, I don't know how it's going to work out, but God has said it will. And so I'm going to trust in the promise more than the circumstance. And God is giving Abraham probably one of the most difficult tests that he will ever lay in front of any human being, minus his own son, to say, I want you to give up what is most precious to you and trust me with it. And God might not come to us and say, hey, I want you to give up your son or your daughter. But what he comes to us and says is, I want you to trust me with what's most precious to you. Put it on the altar and watch me go to work. Watch me bring about resurrection power to broken dreams and broken families and broken marriages and broken whatever. Trust in the promise more than the circumstance and watch me work. And Abraham has finally reached a point where when he hears this crazy promise, he has to be like, I don't understand what the purpose of this is. Like, what could possibly come out of this? Even if he's raised, what have we won? Like, why are you doing this? And then you jump into the story. Abraham couldn't have understood where this was going. But with the benefit of hindsight, we've seen the story of Jesus. We know how this story plays out. We know what his son of promise, who's coming to save all the world and all the nations, what he ultimately did. And so now when we look at the story of what Abraham had to endure in Genesis 22, it becomes unbelievably beautiful as to what God is ultimately pointing us to and the measure of his love. Like, we look at the story and we're shocked, we're offended that God would say, Abraham, I want you to give your son. But what this story then confronts us with is, as human beings that rebelled against God, who spit in his face, who war for the throne, who think we're the center of humanity, we're the one who took God's son and killed him. And it's like, whoa, do you hold yourself to that same level of offense? When God comes to Abraham and says, I want you to give your son, we're so offended. Do we carry that same offense for God, that humanity would look at him and say, I demand you give your son? Mm. And that's our only hope. And you serve a God who loves you so much that, you know what? What does God do? He doesn't do it reluctantly. Jesus doesn't go to the cross reluctantly. It says he goes to the cross for the joy set before him. He goes to redeem you because he loves you that much. And as we're going to see, he will not let Abraham sacrifice his son. But out of love, he will lay down his own son. And when you read the story, which we're about to do, the details leap off the page, and it is a prophetic foreshadowing of what Jesus will do for us. So let's walk through the story and just notice the pattern. You ready? Just Genesis 22, we're reading from the English Standard Version. Verse 1, it says, after these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and Abram said, here I am. He said, now here, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love. Why would God put it that way?
You're really laying it on.
Your son, your only son, whom you love. Can you think of a Bible verse that sounds kind of like that? Your only beloved son? John 3:16, right? For God so loved the world that he gave, right? Take your son, your only son, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah. Now, if you're just reading Genesis 22, that doesn't mean much of anything.
Yeah.
But then you find out that when Solomon builds the temple in Jerusalem, we're told that he builds the temple on Moriah, a mountain range. So we know he's saying, I want you to take your only son, whom you love, and I want you to lead him to Jerusalem. Okay, so that's interesting. And offer him there as a burnt offering. What's a burnt offering? Burnt offering, later on in the law of Moses, you find that's what you did when you were trying to make atonement for sin, when you were offering up thanksgiving, things like that. And so I want you to offer him up as a burnt offering, where on one of the mountains I'll show you. So take your only beloved son and go to Jerusalem and offer him up as an atonement offering on one of the mountains of Jerusalem. Is this ringing any bells yet? So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey. Gee. How did Jesus enter into Jerusalem during Holy Week for the Passion?
On a donkey.
On a donkey. And here you have Abraham, who's going to Jerusalem with his only beloved son, where who's going to be sacrificed on a mountain as a burnt offering, and they enter riding on a donkey with two men associated, coming with him, and his son Isaac. And it says he cut the wood. So in this execution, it involves wood for the burnt offering. And he arose and went to the place that God had told him. And now it's been 3 days since God said, I want you to sacrifice your son. Now get this. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. So for 3 days, Abraham has been grieving the fact his son is going to die. His only beloved son is going to be sacrificed on a mountain in Jerusalem. Grieving that. And on the third day, he looks up and sees the place. And Abraham said to the young man, this is crazy talk. Stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there. And what should he say? And then I will return back to you. But he says, we are going to worship and we will return again to you. He knows he's going to sacrifice him, right? But why would he say, we are going to return to you? Hear the faith in that. Like, I may go through with killing him, but my God is going to raise him from the dead because he will never go back on his promise. He will never go back on his promise to save the nations through my son. I trust him with my whole heart. We will return back to you. And so it says, Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son Isaac. And now just imagine this. Walking up the mountain with the wood of his execution, his son, his only son, whom he loves, on a mountain in Jerusalem after having ridden there on a donkey, he takes the wood and begins to walk up the mountain. Does that ring any bells? It's our Savior who entered into Jerusalem willing to give his own life, the only beloved Son of God who takes the cross and carries his own cross to the place of his execution. So Abraham has laid Isaac, his son, on the wood. He took in his hand the fire and the knife, and they both went on together. And Isaac at this point's like,
he's starting to click.
Yeah, like there's usually for a sacrifice, there's an animal, and we don't have one. And so what does he say? My father, here I am, my son. And he said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And here again, you see Abraham's unbelievable prophetic faith. He says, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And so they went on, both of them together. And when they came to the place which God had told him, Abraham built the altar, and there he laid the wood in order and bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar. Again, Isaac's strong enough to carry his own wood. He's old enough. Abraham's over 100 years old. If Isaac wanted to get away, he could have. Which means Isaac does what?
Believes and trusts his dad, at least.
He believes, and he trusts his dad, and he goes willingly. So he's laying down on top of the wood. Then it says in verse 10, then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son like every other religion of that region would have required. But the angel of the Lord, now this is Jesus, called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. In the ancient East, to repeat someone's name twice is always a sign of affection. Mm. Abraham, you can imagine like the Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing that you've not withheld your son, your only son, from me. You've trusted me with resurrection. You've put your hope, your faith in me. No death comes upon this house. And now comes the kicker, which is just amazing. And Abraham lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram. What's a ram?
It's a male sheep.
We learned this, right? It's a male sheep, an adult male sheep. And it's caught in a thicket by his horns. Now, I want you to imagine this. What's a thicket? It's a bush that has lots of
thorns.
And so here's the replacement sacrifice. A ram with its horns in a thicket. In other words, it is crowned with thorns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. And Abraham at this moment gets it. He's like, I know that this isn't what ultimately is going to be done. And so it says he called that in the name of that place, the Lord will, future tense, provide. As it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord, it shall be provided. And so in this moment, you are given this prophetic, beautiful picture of Abraham who is witnessing, playing out the role. But God says, no, you can't give your son. But you've just lived out a pattern that I'm going to do for you because I'm the God of resurrection. I'm going to give my only son, my beloved son, who's going to go to the land of Moriah, saddled on a donkey. He's going to carry his own wood up the mountain, except this time the father does not stay his hand, because the only chance that you and I can share in the resurrection power, because we're all cursed to die. The wages of sin are death, and we're tainted by that. And the only way that we can be redeemed is if God comes into the world and takes the penalty upon himself, clothes us in righteousness, defeats death, and that's exactly what he did. God gave his only beloved son, defeated death, so that that power of resurrection that Abraham was banking on can be ours. That's the story of the gospel. God is not a malevolent bully. He is not laying down this unbelievable command to Abraham out of cruelty. He's wanting us to see that God would never require us to do something like that. But he loves us so much that he would take that very thing upon himself, and he would give his life. He would give his son so that you and I can be with him forever. It's a beautiful chapter, absolutely stunning.
And the story truly is amazing because of what you just said, that we come to the story just wanting to be offended. Who is this God, this cosmic child abuser that would tell Abraham, hey, you kill your son for me? And we're just horrified by that, thinking, no, I could never follow this God. I could never ask or want to be a part of anything that he is a part of. And yet, when it comes down to it, we allow God to sacrifice his son because we're the true monsters. We're the ones who need to be saved from our sin, who need to come and have a sacrifice on our behalf, just like that ram in the thicket. Mm-hmm. And thanks be to God that it's Jesus and not us.
That's right. And that resurrection power and that ethic of life, that everywhere the gospel goes, it just eradicates child sacrifice. The opposite happens. It brings life and beauty and flourishing to every culture where it's found, and it gets rid of these monstrosities. That's the ethic of our God. Mm. He brings life not just to us eternally, but he brings flourishing and life to everybody in this world that no longer lives under the fear of death, but that recognizes, you know what, like my eternity is secure. I can live in this world with open hands, trusting God and his promise over the circumstance that might not make sense. And this is the kind of story where we look at and go, okay, if he can do that and God rewards him and blesses him like that, when my circumstances don't make sense, I'll trust in the promise of a God of resurrection.
Don't forget to like and subscribe and comment.
Thank you for watching. Join us next time as we go under the hood of another story in the Bible.